Item 2 on our agenda this afternoon is the Judicial Council report to the legislature regarding the implementation of the open meeting rule. And so I invite the presenters, our internal chairs of the Judicial Council, on this action item.
They delegated it to me.
Very good.
On June 14th, 2013, the legislature passed the Budget Act of 2013, and as part of that Budget Act, the legislature added Provision 15, requiring that by October 1st, 2013, the Judicial Council adopt a rule, quote, regarding open meeting requirements for committees and similar multi-body members that review issues and report to the Judicial Council, end of quote. On June 27, 2013, Governor Brown vetoed Proposition 15, but in his veto message urged the Judicial Council to continue efforts to provide greater public access to judicial branch committee activities. In addition to the budget bill language, the legislature also adopted supplemental report language accompanying the Budget Act. This language directed the Judicial Council to report to the Joint Legislative Budget Committee on implementation of an open meetings rule by January 1st, 2014. And the letter that you have attached to this particular report is our proposed letter to the Joint Legislative Budget Committee on the implementation of an open meetings rule. But what I first wanted to do was just remind you what language was included in the supplemental report. And so I'm just going to read it directly. It said, quote, not later than January 1st, 2014, the Judicial Council shall submit to the Joint Legislative Budget Committee a report on the implementation of an open meetings rule in accordance with the following. A, the rule shall apply to any committee, subcommittee, advisory group, working group, task force, or similar multi-member body that reviews issues and reports to the Judicial Council. The rule shall provide for telephone access for requesting persons. The rule shall establish public notice requirements for any meeting of a body described. Number two, for each fiscal year beginning with 2014-2015, the report shall include the rule for that fiscal year and specific detail on amendments to the rule adopted in the prior fiscal year. On November 14th, we held what was probably a unique meeting at the Capitol, and we released at that time a preliminary draft, which we shared with the governor's office, the Department of Finance, the legislative analysis, the media, labor, and other stakeholders. It was an excellent meeting, and we received excellent comments for those who participated. We also released this preliminary rule at that time, which was something unique, for a 20-day comment period. We have been meeting, it almost seems like daily, but at least every other day, working on the open meetings rule, and we met even this morning. And we will have a proposed open meetings rule by December 20th, which fits within our timeline, so that we can release that on that day for, again, public comment. And then at our April meeting, we will have a proposed rule, which we will present to the council for vote. So before I ask you to approve this letter, I have to thank all of those people publicly who have helped with this, because they have been so important, and without them, we couldn't accomplish what we hope to accomplish. That's Jody Patel, Pam Reynolds, Deborah Morrison, Linda Nguyen, Patrick O'Donnell, Nancy Spiro, Nancy Carlisle, Peter Allen, and Debbie Brown, Corey Jasperson, Laura Speed, Sharon Riley, and Peter Allen, and then also the other four internal chairs. They have all been working late in the evening and on the weekends, and we sorely appreciate that. So I'm open to questions. Again, the rule is not attached because it is not complete. It will be ready, we believe, by December 20th. And when this letter goes out on January 1st, that rule will be attached to the letter.
Judge Rosenberg.
Regarding the public comment period, you're going to have two public comment periods. One has already happened, correct?
Yes.
And another one is going to start on the 20th. So my questions are, why I'm not disagreeing with this, but why did you have two public comment periods? And secondly, how long will the public have to comment in this upcoming public comment period?
Sure, that's a great question. And feel free for any of the other chairs to jump in. The public comment period for this second round will be 47 days. And we felt like that this was so important, and we so wanted to get it right, and that it was something unique and involved very intricate balancing of the issues that are special to the judicial branch and especially to the judges who sit on these committees and the ethical ramifications, that we wanted to make sure that we released this in a forum at the Capitol where this was originated to get their input and also to have the opportunity in some sense to express why we had written it in the particular way we had written it and to explain the unique position that judges are on in these committees. And I have to tell you again, it was very well attended. Corey and his office did a great job. Both, we did it twice on November 14th, in the morning and the afternoon. And both times, all the seats were filled. And we had a great dialogue and great questions from them. And it went a long way in what they said and what the comments that we received in helping us formulate the rule that will come out on December 20th. It was invaluable, in my opinion.
The first comment period also involved our colleagues and the committees, because we needed, it was hard for us to envision all the different scenarios that committee members are faced with. And ethically, you know, when they discuss case law and et cetera, where it might pose a problem to them ethically if that meeting were open. So we needed to hear from the chairs of these committees the circumstances under which they might be placed in jeopardy in that regard. So it went out also to colleagues and to the committee chairs and also to anybody in the branch. We got letters and comments and phone calls. So that input was really helpful in us in continuing to form the rule of court that we were still working on this morning. And not to say that more comments that come in the second period will help us as well, but it was invaluable.
Just as a follow-up, I know probably every member of this council is interested in opening up the process to open meetings, but you know, that's easier said than done. There has to be consideration for subjects that can't be open. Personnel issues, litigation, property acquisition. There's a number of things that necessarily have to be done privately. I imagine that's being considered. But also, what about, this doesn't just affect the Judicial Council and the committees. Aren't we also drilling down to the courts of appeal and trial courts, or is that not on this table?
That's not part of this.
Okay.
And I can add that all of the considerations that Judge Rosenberg has just mentioned, including many more, we have been working hard to find a balance to this rule and adding to the answers to your first question. That's one of the reasons we also wanted to open the discussion up early on at the regional meetings to get the early input of all of our colleagues who cared to comment. It was not only unusual. In my experience, it had never been done, but we felt that it was important to get early input from all those branches and then have a second opportunity for the public and whoever wanted to comment once the rule was proposed.
Judge Ellsworth.
It's a strange question. In so many of our meetings, we do them telephonically. Does it contemplate that? And the piece that I think about is how often we shoot emails then as a part of that. Did you contemplate and discuss that as well? Because that, like you said, this further complicates.
Just this morning.
Oh, well, on same page.
Ongoing.
I mean, that's same page. Okay.
It does. It takes into consideration the circulated proposals, which was in our preliminary rule, and we got some excellent comments on how to make that more sensible. And I think they probably were aware, too, that we don't meet that often in person anymore, and so that's why they talked about telephone access, and we've broadened that to include electronic access and other means like that.
Fortunately, all of us have been involved in many committees.
Right.
And so all of us are aware of those situations where it's not resolved in the one in-person or the one phone conference. We need other information, and we need follow-up, and you know, we need to put that over for just that one brief piece of information, and then we can all act, and we're getting input, and that may involve emails, and that might involve more correspondence. So, yes, believe you me, we've, again, the scenarios have been almost endless, and that's what's very difficult about this rule.
I can see it's just
so, you know, and every time we meet, we have a discussion about some new revelation that one or the other of us has awoken in the middle of the night thinking, oh, my God, what about that? So
I have one I just have one thing.
Judge Elias?
When do you think we can get the draft? It would be really good to get it before the 19th. Can we get it, like, at the beginning of the week? No, we can't.
I don't think it's going to be finalized before the 19th at this point. It's a week from today. As Justice Miller said, we were still going through discussions. It's being redrafted as we speak, and staff can only move so quickly on this.
I would imagine we'll be working on it on the morning of the 19th, I mean, because it's so important and there's so many facets to it.
Justice Baxter.
Yes, you might want to consider providing no-dos for those who participate.
Yes, we have such exciting stuff to do. Do you need a motion?
Yeah, but I want to speak to this first. I want to say I think it's a fair statement that we have at Council endeavored to open up our meetings as much as we can from the early part of 2000, in the last 3 years or so. And I would say immediately it started with opening up the education meeting, which had been closed for a number of years. And then I know that Judicial Council, we've had discussions amongst the chairs and members of Council about ways to open up our meeting. But as been expressed here, I think what's not so widely known in the public is that judges have a canons of ethics and a code of ethics that really guides their input, their membership, their communication. Because as the judicial branch, as the arbiter of facts and law, it really requires a judge to be neutral. And so when this concept came of wanting an open meetings rule, we were not opposed to this, but it was a matter of, whoa, we need to draft this ourselves because we have different considerations, and especially because the judicial branch has taken far greater oversight of many, many issues that previously we didn't necessarily have judicial oversight on. And so we wanted to be careful and we wanted to be inclusive. But we also wanted to make sure that we protected and acted in accord with the canons of ethics. And that's why this report is really a work in progress. As more considerations come about and as I see the hard work of the internal chairs and it's discussed, there are other ways that we have to capture because the branch, especially due to contraction of funds, we've had to hold these meetings differently. Far fewer in-person meetings, far more telephone calls, far more video conferences, far more non-in-person meetings. It complicates how you keep a meeting or have a meeting that's open when it's done telephonically. So this is taking time, and there's a lot of discussion behind it because we'd like to do it right the first time before it goes out for public comment so that we can get as much done. We want to front-load it with the ideas first. Justice Baxter.
I think it is important to be fully informed as to the procedures in both the executive branch and the legislative branch in terms of the spirit behind this entire proposal. I mean, I can recall, and I assume it's the same today, that within the executive branch, the senior staff would meet daily, consider issues, make recommendations that ultimately went to the governor, and those meetings were never public because it would chill the conversation as a matter of necessity. And I know that certain meetings within the legislative branch likewise are not public. So I think it's important for the rule to be reflective of what the process is within the executive branch and the judicial and the legislative branch to reflect the spirit behind this.
Thank you. Judge Walsh.
Thank you. I'd like to echo exactly what Justice Baxter just said. I think we have to be careful not to punish ourselves for doing the right thing. Under your leadership, Chief, we have opened up the branch. We have empowered more and more groups to take a look at issues, the kinds of issues that used to be the product of staff work, as Justice Baxter just discussed. Well, because judges are involved in staff work, there's now some sense that we have to open up the staff discussion. And I think we have to be careful about that. Certainly the LAO doesn't open up its staff discussions when it leads to very, very formal papers going to the legislature, and a local city planning department doesn't open its staff discussions when they're going to submit something. But simply because members of the judiciary are on an advisory committee, there shouldn't be a notion that that should be opened up. Now, it's different if it's council members doing council work. But that's well covered. We've opened up the council meetings, and our group I represent, and by the way, I want to compliment Justice Miller and the other four for opening up the process in terms of soliciting input from the chairs of the various committees. We've had several very active meetings. I haven't seen the most recent draft, obviously, but the prior drafts have each reflected changes from those meetings. And the groups, Task Force on Fiscal Accountability, of which I chair, and the Trial Court Presiding Judges Advisory Committee, which I chair, are supportive of opening up any meetings in our branch, council down to subcommittees, if they discuss and decide about the expenditure of public funds or make effective recommendations to do so. So, really, the ultimate decision is only with this body, but the Budget Advisory Committee makes effective recommendations on the expenditure of funds, and Judge Earl and Zacco have opened up those meetings. But when the other advisory committees get together and make simply have discussions on staff issues, I'm not sure that there's any public policy need that outweighs the chilling effect on open, robust discussion that would lead to, in effect, a good staff paper coming to this branch. So as to one of the latest version I saw of the open meeting rule, which is the November version, it talks about open meetings, which would include any committee, subcommittee, reviewing issues that would be reported to the Judicial Council, not the expenditure of funds. Now, maybe that's been fixed since, but to me that's a trap to fall into, because it also could be then if TCP Jack talks about digital court and says, hey, Brian, go up there when you're at the council, please report on our feelings about governance of technology. Well, if I'm reporting on what we reviewed, then that whole meeting had to be open up on that. Or on financial accountability. If it's we're talking on whether or not an efficiency might be getting e-signatures on probable cause findings, something we're talking about. Well, the fact that I might report that to this group, we have no power. We have no power to affect that change as an advisory committee. So I'm not understanding why there's a public need outweighing the difficulties. A public need that, by the way, as Justice Baxter just said, has not driven the other staff groups that feed the legislature or the governor to open up their discussions. So I hope that while we all know we want to embrace the notion that public funds should be decided upon and expended only in public forums, lots of other things we do for good reasons, for which the public is not an appropriate part of that discussion.
Angela Davis, and then Senator Evans.
In addition to the comments about chilling effect and whether I think in some instances it might be debatable whether the public has an interest in a particular issue, However, I tend to agree with the comments that this is really most relevant when a decision is being made on budget and finance. And one of my concerns, in addition to the chilling effect and all of that, is just the practicality. Subcommittee, what's the definition of that? If, for example, one of the standing committees of the Judicial Council is having a conference call, say it's RUPRO, and they're looking at modifying a rule for juvenile justice court, and there's an issue of law that it's decided amongst the members of the committee that maybe two people should go off and take a look at what other jurisdictions are doing, so two people, say Justice Ashman Gerst and Judge Elias, are assigned to report back to the committee on what another jurisdiction has done in a similar situation. Is that a subcommittee? And if it is a subcommittee, then those two people need to provide notice of when they're meeting and need to open up their communications to the public. And that's where I have a concern. In addition to the chilling effect, I think there are some real practicality concerns. The State Bar Board of Governors went through a very similar exercise 2 years ago when it was specifically directed by the legislature to report, to put together a task force and prepare a comprehensive report on how the state bar could be more accountable to the public. And we found it very difficult with regard to the practicality issues and the notice requirements. A strict application of the Brown Act would require us to put it on the website and provide notice to the public any time not just an official subcommittee or committee was meeting, but even if three or four members of a committee that has eight members or seven members in total is together discussing an issue, that's a violation of the rule. And so I trust that they are, but just to throw into the mix another concern in addition to chilling effect and everything else, I think there are some practicality issues.
Thank you. Senator Evans, and then Justice Hull.
Thank you. I just wanted to express my appreciation listening to this conversation because I've spent now 20 years of my life being subject to various open meeting laws, both in local government and in the California State Legislature, and it is not easy. All of our task forces, working groups, subcommittees, committees, standing committees, select committees, et cetera, are all subject to open meeting laws, and it's very difficult to be able sometimes to transact business because it's a challenge. And I appreciate the fact that everybody's trying to struggle with this now. And I also want to mention this level of transparency, both that the Judicial Council is operating under now and is looking at operating under in the future, is really unprecedented, particularly for the judiciary. And it is uncomfortable, and I understand that. It's something that's relatively new here, and I thank the Chief Justice for your leadership in this area. But I think it's particularly critical because, especially in the last few years when budgets have become so tight, what we're seeing is a reduction in public trust of our institutions. And I believe that trust cannot be restored without some level of transparency. And as difficult as that is, I think in the long run it's really worthwhile. And I just want to express my appreciation for the struggles that everybody is having right now to meet the mandate that the legislature put on you in the last year.
Thank you, Senator Evans. Justice Hull.
I just, Chief, wanted to build a little bit on Judge Walsh's and Ms. Davis's comments referring to chilling, if you will. It's been squarely in the middle of our considerations that with all of the advisory committees, all of the working groups, all of the task forces, they are populated largely, not exclusively, but largely by judges. And as judges, as the Chief has mentioned, we are bound by the judicial canons of ethics, one of which says that it is inappropriate. Well, we are not allowed to discuss publicly matters that are pending or impending. And we are so, the branch and the council's work is so dependent upon the willing participation of so many members of the judiciary that there is a companion concern that if they think that they are being put in jeopardy of, during the course of their discussions, violating the canons of ethics, that that will in turn make more difficult, to say the least, our ability to have judges of good faith come forward and continue the work that so many have done in the past. And so these are all valid considerations. They're considerations that, at least as to the canons of ethics, are special to the branch. And we're trying, and I do, like Justice Miller, I tend to be an optimist in life, and I do think that we are going to be able to present to the council in April a rule that has an appropriate balancing of these considerations.
Justice Herman, then Justice So. And then
thank you for the question, Chief. And the ethical piece is a two-prong piece. Not only are we constrained ethically from making public comment in areas of law that are pending in one way or another, or impending in one way or another, but also we're required by the canons to adjudicate and preside over cases and not put ourselves in the position in making public comment on legal issues that would make us vulnerable to either having to recuse ourselves from a particular case or being challenged in particular cases. So these are important concepts that we've struggled with, worked with, but we're sort of in a unique position relative to those ethical constraints.
At the same time, we are well aware of how important it is to the public that the judiciary show how money is being spent and the budget aspect of it. And I think you will see when this rule comes out that we've tried to balance all of that. And I think we have walked the tightrope, but I think we will make it to the other side.
Judge D'Alba, then Judge Brandlin.
Thank you, Chief. I agree largely with everything that's been said here this afternoon. I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that this language that's compelled us to this point, as has been said by Judge So and others, comes from a budget committee. We, as judges and justices, are specialists, I think, in doing our business in public. That's what we do every day. And so I think the legislature, by this directive, obviously, is saying, well, the people's business includes the expenditure of their resources, so that has to be or should be public. And I don't think I hear anybody quarreling with that or has, in principle, any argument with that. What I was concerned about when I first saw a draft, I suspect it was the first draft, was that the language that was offered for the rule seemed to be awfully expansive, far beyond budgetary issues. The language from the budget committee suggests access. And what I thought I saw in the proposed rule was almost participation, or maybe in fact participation from stakeholders or public members. So I'm not sure if that's what the new or latest version of the rule will offer, but I think it's a very different impact on our committees. If it's simply notice, access, opportunity to hear, as opposed to participation. And I also wonder, I know the senator said it's unprecedented, whether any other court system in the United States has a similar rule. If that was researched or investigated, I'd be anxious to know. And
the answer is yes, and I think you will find that the rule that we will be putting forth will be at the forefront of open meeting rules for the judiciary.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Judge D'Alba. Judge Brandlin.
Thank you, Chief. I just wanted to follow up on a comment that Justice Hull made regarding our dissimilarity because of the nature of our canons of ethics that separates this branch of government from other branches of government. And I think that we need to be very cautious and very careful in the way in which this rule is designed, because what my concern is the rule of unintended consequences. We encourage judicial officers to be active participants in these advisory groups and task forces, et cetera. My fear is if because of the concern of our restrictions, because of the canons of ethics, that we have a chilling effect and a withdrawal of judicial officers, the only individuals in essence representing the branch may in fact be staff personnel. And we have certainly been criticized in the past for not actively participating in overseeing AOC staff. And if we don't have judicial officers that are willing to participate in these task forces and advisory committees, we're going to be putting ourselves back in that position.
Thank you, Judge Brandlin.
So we would ask for a motion to recommend approval of the attached letter that's in on January 1st.
Chief, I'll so move.
Thank you, Judge D'Alba. Is there a second?
Second, Stout.
Thank you, Judge Stout. No further discussion. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Justice Miller. Thank you, the internal chairs. This concludes our audio cast of the agenda items for today's business meeting. And after a short break, we, as you know from our agenda, and we're running a little bit ahead, we will reconvene in the Milton Marks Conference Center Auditorium, the lower level, at 4:30 for the beginning and the presentation of the 2013 Judicial Council Distinguished Service Awards and the Benjamin Aranda III Access to Justice Award. For those listening, we will also then reconvene here again tomorrow at 8:30 in the morning for the remainder of our business meeting agenda. See you at 4:30 in the auditorium. Thank you.